Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So hey everybody, welcome to episode 216 of the Morning Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitra and I am in Toronto, Ontario. I'm joined as usual by Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And also have Mark Rubin down in San Jose, California.
Hello.
Alrighty. So what do we got for AskMask and TJC there, Jaime?
We've got a couple from Paul Wilkinson, a friend of the show at Paul Wilco, who is talking about the eSIM stuff that we were mentioning. He says here in the first tweet that eSIM is a carrier thing, not an Apple thing. As yet, none of the three Australian mobile networks support it for phones, but all three do for the Apple Watch. I expect they are working on it, which is kind of an interesting thing that they would do it for the watch and not necessarily for the phones. I wonder what the holdup is there. The second tweet that's somewhat related there is that Australian retail prices include our 10% sales tax. Once you remove the tax, the Australian price for a base iPhone XS comes out at about US 1,046, about $50 more, but we have a small population and a minimum wage of about US $13. So costs here are higher.
Mm-hmm. Yes, based on my comment. My information may have been old, but I do remember talking to some pals from Australia about the fact that they pay a lot, and Europe. I think Europe pays a lot for Apple gear as well. But it's good to say, I mean, like, you know, and I've mentioned many times before, for some reason, Apple gear, just add $50 to the US price and then convert it to Canadian is what works up here too. So cool. What else we got for AskMTJC?
Do you want to take these? These are both yours.
Well, yeah. Yeah, this is me, tongue firmly planted in cheek. I got my 50th anniversary t-shirt from Buzz Aldrin himself, and I put out my tweet saying I got my Apollo XI t-shirt. Or I put X1 actually in the tweet, but yeah, just playing on the fact that people cannot get their heads around the fact that, you know, it's iPhone 10 or iPhone 11 or whatever, right? So
right, the Apollo 10i.
Yeah, and I remembered that, or your XI, right? And I remember that I think it was around the time of the Apollo missions that I first learned my Roman numerals. When I learned, you know, X was 10 and, you know, XI was 11 and so on and so forth, right? So because all of the missions were Apollo it was always spelt with Roman numerals. Never a number. That's cool. So, yeah, and these t-shirts are available from Buzz Aldrin's website. I forget the name of it. I'll put it in the show notes, a link to it. And if you're interested in getting an Apollo t-shirt for the 50th anniversary, which is coming up in next July. It's July, right? Of next year was the 50th anniversary. So, and of course, you know, this weekend, the First Man movie opens up as well. So the second AskMTJC, and I tagged this in here, was I got an email again today from Wikipedia. I get one every year. Every year I donate a little bit of money to Wikipedia, because I don't know about you guys, but I use Wikipedia all the time, and it's not a place that makes money. They don't have ads and stuff like that. Well, I think they have minimal ads, if they have ads at all. But yeah, they need your money to keep it going, so I'm happy to send, you know, $20 or $50 or whatever it takes to help support them in their efforts to keep, you know, our knowledge going. So yeah, support Wikipedia. Link in the show notes. And that's it for me. So what do we got for follow-up? How many, you got something here about betas?
Yeah, we were talking about the fact that Test Flight now allows you to have betas where you can invite people with something as simple as a link.
Right.
And people have taken that idea and run with it. So publicbetas.com is, I don't see the about, but it's a place where you can add your public beta link. So if you wanted other people to try out your app and get the word out, right at the recording of this show, we have the top three that I see. I assume the top three, they're like on fire here, are Mojo, Hackers for Hacker News, and Snapchat has an iOS beta out available. So again,
those are not the ones that I see.
Oh, really?
That's a different list? Todoist, Mojo, and Telegram Messenger.
Yeah, same here.
Oh, interesting. I wonder if
maybe
it's personalized in any way.
Let's try refreshing, honey.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Wait, is it random? So I do Todoist, Mojo, Telegram Messenger.
That's what I have, too.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, so I opened up this tab maybe 10 minutes ago, so I wonder if it's changed in real time.
Hmm. Cool. Well, my follow-up on that is that James Thompson sent me a public beta to test out the new pCalc, and yeah, so it's cool. All right, that's a neat idea to throw that out there. What else you got there for Jaime?
Yeah, I'm not even sure how much to say about this story, but
another leak? I can't believe it.
Well, it's weird because it's technically not a breach, at least as far as we know, but Google Plus is shutting down after a data leak that affects 500,000 users. Apparently, Google knew about this for a while and had patched it at some point, decided to not disclose it because it's sort of a bad time for data breaches and public relations. If you can think about Equifax and probably Cambridge Analytica related to Facebook, they decided not to disclose. As far as they could tell, and granted, the huge caveat is they only keep 2 weeks of logs. So all they can verify is that within that 2 week period they looked at, nobody took advantage of this privacy hole here. So they're claiming, well, it wasn't technically a breach because we didn't see any, you know, intrusion. You know, you could leave your door unlocked, and if nobody comes in, you know, you didn't have a robbery. But yeah, okay, but I'd still blame the doorman for not locking the door if he doesn't do it, right? It's sort of a sad end to the Google Plus social network experiment, and Google is sort of weirdly slamming it itself by saying, oh, well, you know, 90% of users have sessions that are less than 5 seconds. Like, well, okay, but that doesn't mean that the privacy aspect isn't, you know, something to just sneeze at. And Congress, the U.S. Congress, is apparently starting to talk about investigating this situation.
Interesting. So I thought they were shutting down while they explored this, but you're saying they're shutting the service down completely?
To be clear, it's the public-facing side. I don't know what the non-public side is. I don't know if there's like an enterprise thing or like a business class or something related to it.
Maybe.
Yeah. Most folks probably remember Google Plus from the... I'm almost certain at some point during our show many years ago, I pulled up this same exact image, and we'll have it in the show notes for those of you driving at home, which is a three-panel comic. It shows a little child as representing Google Plus and their parent represented by Google, and says, "Papa, why do they not love me? I do not know, little one, but it is of no concern. I will make them love you." With a really weird, creepy thing. And it seems perfectly appropriate here that that's what Google was trying to do. They shoved Google Plus everywhere, most notably forcing it to be a login mechanism for YouTube, which had its own completely separate identity system. Everybody got really angry. They shoved it into everything. They were, if you remember in 2011, they were woefully behind Facebook as far as they could tell with relation to owning people's sort of social network and information, and were completely afraid of being locked out of all information if the internet became synonymous with Facebook. Didn't really turn out 100% that way. It turned out slightly different. Google is obviously doing fine and well and dandy as a company, but Google Plus, at least as far as you as a consumer are concerned, is no more. And your data may or may not have been leaked. I'm not a lawyer or a security person.
I'm surprised to hear that they still had 500,000 users, actually, at this point.
Well, the usage information that they said, you know, 90% of sessions are 5 seconds or less, really heavily implies that people are using it as some sort of login mechanism somewhere.
Yeah, true.
So it seems like nobody's seriously using it. I do know that there are groups out there that use it for like beta, like public beta channels on their Android phone, Android apps. But as far as the average person on the street, there's just no way. They lost the battle to Facebook and Snapchat and Twitter and everybody else.
Yeah. I know a few sites that I'm connected to that use my Google profile, Google Plus profile as a sort of like a byline thing for my who I am and all that kind of stuff. But it's interesting. I didn't talk about this last week, but on the 2nd of October, my article on 360 iDev came out. And the reason I bring it up is because Rob Napier's talk, he always talks about security, and his talk was called Security and Lies. And it was he was talking about how there's two different kinds of security. One is where you sort of obfuscate things and you encrypt things and you use secure keys and all that kind of stuff. The other is security through obscurity, right? And that, like the example he gave was that the Americans use Navajo talkers to encrypt messages and decrypt them, right? And whereas the Germans took a more traditional route and came up with the Enigma machine, in which eventually the British allies or Alan Turing and the British hacked and figured out how to decrypt the things. But in the entire time that the Navajo talkers were being used by the American army to encrypt messages, no one ever cracked their code, right? And all it was just they were talking in their own native language, and it was through the obscurity of the language that they were able to keep the data secure. And this kind of sort of sounds like what you were saying with Google. They kind of knew there was a problem, but they kind of just kept quiet about it. And another example from the talk was the manufacturing of locks, keys and locks, right? And there's been a flaw in keys and locks for 100 years or more, that ever since they were invented by Alfred Charles Hobbs in 1800s, that in some cases you can actually take hack a key to make it into a master key and open multiple locks based on the same key set, and they're easy to pick. And yet the whole lock manufacturing network of people just didn't want people to know about this. So to this day, keys and locks in most cases are easily hackable and break, and they're not secure, right? It's just that they don't publish the information on how to, and they're saying, why are you telling people this? Like, because it's through this obscurity. So it's kind of a sad state of security that it is secure in the fact that nobody kind of knows about it, but it's eventually going to catch up with them, right?
So, well, it's sort of even worse than that. If you go to the hardware store and buy one of those, say a master lock with a key, you think that they actually make every single one of those locks has a unique key?
No way.
They probably have, a few hundred different keys that they scatter around the country. Yep. And they're just counting on the fact that no one's going to collect every possible key and spend the time trying every possible key on your lock to try to open it. But somebody else has the key to your lock, no matter what you get.
Exactly. Like, I remember hearing about people, like, you could walk up to any, if you had a Honda key, you could walk up to, a Honda and, chances are you could open that Honda and start the car, right? Which is why they went to having things like immobilizer chips and stuff like that in the circuitry to, to prevent that kind of thing. But yeah, it's kind of funny that, this is the same sort of thing. Well, we're secure because nobody knows it's vulnerable, right? It's comical. I mean, interesting video there. I've got a talk on the Ray Wunderlich website called 360 iDev Conference Highlights. So check it out if you have the time, and I'll put a link in the show notes to that. But it's a good talk on security.
I always thought of security by obscurity in a slightly different way. I always thought of it as, say you have your computer and it's on a network somewhere and it's completely unprotected. If you don't do something to attract attention to yourself, chances are that no one's going to hack you just because there's so many people out there. If you don't attract attention to yourself, they're not going to know you're there. Of course, it's always possible that they'll stumble on you or try to do some just massive search to find you and then try to hack you. But the odds against that are pretty high. So
that's true.
Like I said, as long as you don't do something to attract attention to yourself or go to the wrong place, you're probably actually okay, even with no security.
Yeah, there's even a sort of a side twist to that. We had our house broken into about the second year we were living in this neighborhood, because we're right downtown Toronto, and kids, there are little alleyways and stuff like that around the neighborhood where kids can hide and take their time to break into a house. But so a friend of mine who works in the security industry He said, well, the first thing you do is you put security stickers on your windows, right? Mm. Because they're less likely to try and break into a house that may have a security system than one that doesn't have.
Yeah.
You know?
You remember a lot of cars used to have a little, just a little flashing LED that did absolutely nothing except that. It wasn't actually an alarm, but people would think that maybe that's an alarm, so I better not mess with this car because there's another car right here that doesn't have a little flashing LED.
Yeah. Well, I know a friend of mine who lives in New York City. I don't know if it's still true, but he used to have a car, and he said you put a sign in the window that said no radio, no money, no cash, and the doors are unlocked.
Yeah.
Because it's a pain in the ass if somebody breaks your window. It costs you $250 to, you know, replace your window, right?
Yeah.
You know, and you know your car is going to get broken into, so just leave the doors open, you know? Like, what's the worst that can happen? Somebody will sleep in your car, right? Anyhow.
Well, they might steal your car.
Well,
depends on whether you care about your car getting stolen.
Well, but then again, you don't have, like, you know, if you have a decent car, you wouldn't leave it on the street parked in New York, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember the story, like back in the day, it used to be a joke that you'd leave your car and you'd come back and find it up on cinder blocks, right? Because they'd steal your wheels.
Sure.
That happened to my wife once. She had her wheel stolen in the parking lot once during Christmas, which is, what? Huh. Somebody had a flat or something, you know, whatever. Security by convenience, I guess.
Yeah.
All right. So what's next? You got, speaking of Facebook, honey.
Right. It's just in line in time for all sorts of goodness related to data privacy questions. Facebook has unveiled its own smart displays, which are very similar to the Amazon Echo Show and competitor from
Google. Apple FaceTime.
Yeah. You imagine them. They're little screen devices that have cameras on them, and you can communicate with or video chat with friends and family using Facebook Messenger. They've done some sort of interesting things that they've apparently trained the camera so that it will try to keep your face in focus and in frame, so you don't have to worry about sort of awkwardly framing yourself within the video. And they show you know, you can move around and it will sort of Hollywood camera style try to pan in on you. And their larger device, it's like, how many inches? Is it 15 inch? Yeah, 15 inch device has a rotatable vertical sort of portrait mode that also can rotate to follow you around a room. They show this person like walking around the kitchen, for example, and it's rotating to keep them in frame, which would be sort of weird in and of itself. But given, I think, people's sort of opinion on Facebook in general, much more so nowadays, it seems a little ill-advised, and I can't imagine a ton of people clamoring to have this, even though they're $199 and $349 respectively.
People will buy it. That's the worst part about it, you know?
Yeah. It does, interestingly enough, have sort of its own little assistant system, but also has the Amazon Alexa voice assistant on there as well. I don't have a lot of information on that. It is something that Amazon provides as a, like an SDK. I don't know if it's open or if you have to be like a partner to put it on devices, but it's, from what I can tell, reasonably close to the full sort of Echo experience. Not quite as tightly integrated for things like purchasing, I think. So it's more like a question and answer sort of service. I'm not sure. I do know that there are devices out there that have licensed it, like Sonos is one that comes to mind as an obvious competitor. And very similar to the way that Google's Assistant is not only on its own recently announced Google Home Hub, but also on Lenovo and JBL's display devices, very similar to this.
Yeah, so that's the question. Like, why would people give Facebook more data? But they will.
Yeah. The rumor is that this was supposed to come out last year, and then Cambridge Analytica happened, and Facebook wisely delayed it. I think if it was, as I've mentioned many times on the show over the years, if I had a consultancy that, you know, I charge $10,000 per hour and companies can just ask me like, hey, do you think this is a good idea? Should we do this? And I could just say yes or no. This is one I definitely would have said no to last year. This year, if they said, look, we have to use up the manufacturing capacity, otherwise the producer in China is going to give it to somebody else and we'll have lost all this money. All right, let's rebrand this and let's put some Instagram stickers on this thing and not put Facebook on it. Let's make it more of a connect with influencers like Lady Gaga or Philip DeFranco, The Rock, you know, that sort of thing. And people can join into this like huge multi-chat sort of thing. Let's go chat with the participants who didn't win on The Voice and let's understand their experience. You know, that sort of thing is where I would have gone with it.
Crazy. All right. Well, we'll see. We're interested to see what happens with that. So we have a new scale out there in the world of computing. And this is sort of tongue firmly planted in cheek. And this relates back to to the public betas that Jaime was talking about, but I got a public beta from James Thompson for the pCalc app so I could try out the new emoji kind of style animation that he's got on the phone. He's got this little guy named Pascal who's like a sort of, I think he's a panda bear, who is like a sort of like a Tamagotchi kind of thing. You look at it different times a day and it has different animations, but there's an Easter egg in the pCalc app on the watch. If you go into the, if you type in 42 on the calculator and you click and you press and you force press on the screen and go to info, you get like a 42 circle, like an icon, and you can spin it by swiping back and forth on your display, and it animates really quickly. It's if you put it in there, sort of a test to test the speed of the animation on the Apple Watch. This is for the Series 4 watch, and there's a button in the corner that if you press the button, you can get up to 100 bananas falling on the shield that you've been spinning, and it's a pretty quick animation. And I think you just did it again as a sort of proof of concept to show that you know how quickly you can generate 100 bananas and have them fall with gravity onto the bottom of the screen. I'm proposing that we have a new scale of performance and how many bananas you can have fall on something, you know, in terms of processor performance. So there you go, bananas.
Well, if you're going to propose that, you have to write the test bench.
Shocker, the iPhone XS is better than the Mac Pro at producing bananas.
How do I write that test bench?
Start learning SceneKit.
Oh, SceneKit, yeah. All right, okay. Well, I already know a bit about SceneKit. Anyway, moving on to more follow-up. So last week, again, we talked about Shakib Sheikh is his name. He was interviewed on Spark on CBC Radio on Sunday's show. So I've put a link to the interview here you can listen to and hear more from the speaker's mouth himself. He says the title of the show is I Made the App That I Wanted. And he basically it's using AI to describe the world to him, which he can't see because he's visually impaired, completely blind. So he built this app using Microsoft Technology Works. He's an engineer at Microsoft, and so just an article here, interview by him, if you're interested in following up on that story. It's kind of cool.
This is really long-term follow-up. I think you mean it as follow-up from last week or maybe two episodes ago?
It was 2 weeks ago I mentioned him for the first time. Last week it was a fact check, and this week it's follow-up. So, yeah.
Now that I see this CBC page, it's even longer term follow-up because I remember this app. I think it was a pick of the week I had at some point.
Oh, really?
We were talking about, let's see, if it was around Core ML coming out, probably so it was like a year or two ago.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that seeing a talking app, the little photo they show at the top of
I mentioned it last week. I've actually got that on my phone. So when he was doing his talk at Elevate conference that I went to a couple of weeks ago, I pulled it out and said, oh yeah, I remember this guy. Yeah, seeing AI is called or something like that, or...
Yeah, I didn't remember the name, but looking at the photo at the very top of this post, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that app from Microsoft, from their labs or garage team. I forget what they call them.
Yeah, so what does Greg call this? Evergreen follow-up? I forget what he calls it. When we have a long-term one like this.
Yeah, with a long enough scale, everything is eventually follow-up.
That's true. Yeah, so there you go. Just more follow-up. And speaking of more follow-up, but wait, there's more. How much more would you pay? Luna Display, which we talked about a couple of times, actually, many times. Actually, they're the people who make AstroPad for the which we talked about when I got my iPad Pro using the Apple Pencil. I could, you know, draw in Photoshop, you know, on my Mac, but I could have the Luna screen or the AstroPad as sort of a virtual second screen using it like a Wacom tablet. And they came out with a piece of hardware which you stick it into your Thunderbolt port or your one of your USB-C slots on if you have a late model MacBook or MacBook Pro. But this product is now shipping and available in both Thunderbolt and USB-C, and lets your iPad be a second monitor on your Mac, or actually mirror the monitor on your Mac. So you can actually sit on the couch and drive your Mac remotely across, you know, your home network, so, or I guess Wi-Fi network or Bluetooth network. And again, it's double follow-up because he was also interviewed on Roundabout Creative Chaos by Tammy and myself a few months ago. So just a link in the show notes. Quick one, quick follow-up from that one. So what's next, Emmy?
This one I'm going to talk a little bit about and then probably pass it off to Mark to talk about the implications. This is something coming out of, what is the first name? Is it Michael Tsai? Yeah, there we go. Michael Tsai, click, running up some issues that people are having with iOS 12 and Core Data external binary data storage. And so the claim here is that somebody was having an issue where using the external storage option, and my understanding is people would tend to use it for large blobs of some sort, like videos and images that you wouldn't necessarily want to store in the database itself within Core Data to for performance reasons, but you would have it referenced separately so it could be pulled up when you use Core Data as you do every day. Apparently, the information would get corrupted or go missing on every second save of the context, which is like a huge issue that people are wrestling with right now. And there's several links wrapped up into this one report. So something to know about for sure.
Yeah, this is pretty bad. I haven't been hit by this myself because I'm not using external binary data storage, but I could easily see it hurting a lot of people. I mean, so it's a pretty typical thing to do if you deal with photos or videos or whatever, to keep a reference to your binary data in your Core Data database or your SQL database, and then just you look up the reference and use that as a, say, URL to open your file. And in theory, Core Data makes it much, much easier to do that than it would normally be with this external binary data storage. It basically gives you a record that stores this link to your data, but does it transparently. So you give Core Data your data, and it puts it somewhere and keeps the reference internally. So if you look up your object, you get your binary data back without having to get the reference and then load it yourself. So it seems like it would be an incredibly convenient and useful thing to do. But if it does this, if it loses the data, that's pretty bad. And apparently it's not as simple as, you know, it's just the reference is getting broken and the data is still there in your disk. From what I've been reading, it's the data itself is actually getting corrupted, which is awful. So if you have a photo storage app where you're just keeping people's photos and this happens, then, you know, their photos are just gone. Pretty bad. So I've never actually used it myself, even though I've done this type of app, mainly because I just never was able to get it working in a satisfactory way. You know, I would always kind of write my own to do the lookups in the way I just described. And I guess I was lucky that I didn't do that.
So Jaime, do you know if this is fixed in that 12.01 update you're talking about?
I have no idea. It's that's a really good question. As I'm looking at some of the updates since I first read this article, it looks like some folks like Colin Cornaby is saying that his team has tried reproducing it in their own apps and they can't. They're not saying it doesn't exist, but that for some reason they can't reproduce it in their apps. Let me take a look at this article and my own little local update. I don't see anything listed here in the update, nor did I find it in the article. So it's a really good question. It might be one of those things that sort of get shadow updates related to this. Like maybe they end up closing a radar on Open Radar or something.
So what's the state of the developer community there, Jaime?
This was a nifty link from JetBrains, the maker of all sorts of IDEs, including AppCode, the alternative to Xcode that a lot of folks like to use. If you know folks that use Android Studio, they're the makers of that. They've got this survey here that was apparently shown to developers who chose Swift or Objective-C as their one of their three primary programming languages. We got nifty charts talking about Swift and Objective-C usage, such as Swift only, Objective-C only, or a combined Swift and Objective-C. And at least for this audience, it was about 54% Swift only, 30% Objective-C only, and the remainder of 16% Swift and Objective-C combined, which is sort of an interesting number to get to. Kind of no surprise, Apple platforms that are being developed for iOS is king of the mountain. People also develop for the Mac to a lesser degree, watchOS and tvOS rounding out things. There's probably some other stats that are interesting out there. Like it seems like people are staying relatively up to date with Swift. 4.1 is 44% of the versions that being used. 4 is 39%. And then some folks sort of lagging behind at 10 and 7% for Swift 3.1 and 3. And there's some other things. You can check out the link in the show notes. I don't know if you guys had a chance to look at this and see if there was an interesting, like, holy smokes, that didn't come to mind as something that people would do.
Yeah, one thing that kind of surprised me was, and now I'm trying to find it in here, I said earlier, the numbers on how many people were using combined either Swift or Objective-C and C++ type solutions. And it was a pretty high number. Now I can't seem to find it, but it's in here somewhere. And it was much higher than expected. And but
I see. It's not a chart. It's actually a gray bar.
Yeah, 36% of Swift developers have C++ code or libs in their project. So that one.
Yeah, I thought there was more info, but yeah, okay. So that, yeah. So I see that. Yeah. So I kind of wonder if the audience here is a bit self-selecting. So this was a poll of people who are users of JetBrains tools, I think, or at least they're on some type of JetBrains mailing list or mm-hmm. whatever. I know that at my company, for example, a lot of people use CLion, which is their C++ IDE. So I kind of suspect that they're self-selecting the user base to make those numbers higher. I don't mean to imply that they're picking the users. I just mean that the people who chose to respond to the survey are more likely to be ones who are using cross-platform tools because they're already JetBrains customers, if you follow what I'm saying. I think a lot of the pure iOS developers who are doing everything in Swift or everything in Objective-C, they don't have really a whole lot of use for the tools that JetBrains is making, so they wouldn't be likely to show up in this survey. So I would take these numbers with a little bit of a grain of salt.
Yeah, I do agree that it's probably ends up being skewed. Like, I'm not surprised that there are fewer users, developers in Swift that use C++ code or libraries as opposed to Objective-C developers, if only because integrating Swift and C++ can be sort of painful. But these specific numbers do seem like they would probably be skewed by, as you mentioned, the specific audience for this survey.
Yep. These guys, by the way, I don't know if you mentioned it, are the ones who also developed Kotlin, which is the alternative language to Java for doing Android apps.
Right. It's sort of our sister language. You look at a line of, or several lines of Kotlin and Swift, and you may not be able to tell the two apart depending on what somebody has written.
Yeah, so there was an interesting thing. I don't know if you guys saw this at all, but I started seeing signs of this first article that came. These the next three articles are related, that Apple was telling Congress that it found no signs of a hacking attack. So I started looking into it, and I found that there was an article on Bloomberg which talks about the big hack, as they call it. And there are tons of stories, tons of websites and things like that picked up on this story. And I kind of wonder if it's kind of a fake news story or it's been blown out of proportion. But they're claiming that Chinese manufacturers have put a tiny chip onto most motherboards that give them a back door into those motherboards or those boards, like whether it's the networking equipment or server boards and that kind of stuff, right? But what caught my eye was this sort of rebuttal to the thing. And this just the other day I found an article actually from Apple's newsroom where they claim that they were, like, according to the Bloomberg article, you know, people at Apple were feeding information to Bloomberg, and, you know, Apple had been investigated by the FBI and so on and so forth. And so the statement from Apple that came out on the 4th talks about how they were never contacted, that they have investigated things themselves, and they don't have any of these boards that Bloomberg claims Apple's been using. Like, one of them is a board made by I can't find the name right now, but
Supermicro.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah, and they said they don't have those boards in the equipment that Bloomberg is claiming they do. They haven't been talking to the FBI unlike Apple, they've come out and said that they're not doing this kind of stuff. Apple usually keeps this kind of information to themselves, and also a claim that Topsy, I'm not sure what Topsy is, but Topsy and Siri were on the same bunch of servers, and Apple's saying, well, Topsy and server have never actually been on the same servers at the same time, so I'm not sure what Topsy is. But it's just sort of Apple says here that before they put their equipment into practice, they keep track of it, and they monitor the network or the traffic coming in and out to make sure that everything's above board. So kind of surprising that this article came out, and like I said, I Googled around for the last couple of days checking this out, and if you Google, you know, Chinese hack, you know, Apple, and there's a couple of other manufacturers are mentioned in here in this original Bloomberg article. There are tons of people out there talking about this particular thing. So I don't know if you guys had heard about this at all.
This is huge news. Mm-hmm. Here.
Yeah.
But as far as I know, it it's been pretty thoroughly debunked that it was false. There was an article that I read, and I don't have it at the readily available, but apparently there is a hardware security expert who basically teaches classes on theoretical threats to hardware, or I don't know if he teaches a class, but it's, you know, he has a seminar or whatever. And he was interviewed by the Bloomberg author, the guy who wrote the article.
Right. Yeah.
And basically, he was saying theoretically, this is how one might consider doing it. And pretty much everything he said was in the article, the Bloomberg article, saying that this was happening. So you know, it seems to be pretty hard to believe that it could happen, because I don't believe for a second that Apple isn't inspecting every single a representative board of every single piece of hardware that comes through. And I think they would detect it pretty quickly. I mean, you can tell just probably by a visual inspection. I mean, you know, even though it's a small thing, you know, they have people looking at every single inch of that board under microscopes, and you could probably tell electrically too. That thing has to draw power, especially if it's a radio. It's going to broadcast, right? It's going to affect the performance in some way of the overall circuit. So in a presumably a detectable way, if you're paying attention, and I have to think that Apple's paying attention. So it doesn't really seem too plausible. And like I said, it seems to have been pretty debunked.
Right. Yeah. And to follow up what I was saying earlier, it's not just Apple, it's also Amazon Web Services, right, are sort of implied, you know, Olympic Games is mentioned in here in this article as well. So, because like I said, what caught my eye was an article that basically said that this is all, it wasn't being debunked, like as you said, like it wasn't a true story or wasn't factual in a lot of different ways. So,
yeah,
and people were retorting it. So I just, you know, wonder if you guys had heard it and heard about it, right? So, Hami, did you hear something about it? Or you were going to say something? Or
let's not underplay Amazon's role in this too, because they also came out and very publicly and vehemently denied these claims. And it's been interesting to see sort of the tech sphere of influence and how it sort of interprets this. There are people all over the spectrum of like where they think on this. To no one's surprise, people who are ardent Apple fans think like no way in heck. People who are in the journalism or were in a journalist sort of space have been like, well, you know, Bloomberg's a really well respected place, and if they're, you know, doubling down on this, there must be something to it. And so I really don't know what to think. I mean, when I think of the what could possibly happen and who stands to lose, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a security expert. I would think, look, for Apple and Amazon, they're having to think about potential SEC violations if they say this is not true and it turns out to be, because that impacts investors' ability to deal with things. If they're going to get directly investigated by Congress, they have to tell the truth to Congress. Otherwise, you know, in both those cases, people are probably going to jail if they're doing the wrong thing. So I would say, what's the worst possible thing that could happen to Bloomberg? Multi-million-dollar lawsuit, whatever. They're more than large enough to deal with that risk. So I think if anybody's not covering their bases appropriately and who has the most to gain with the least amount to lose, it's probably Bloomberg. Not to say that they're doing things maliciously. It certainly seems, of more information to come out, that somebody wildly misunderstood what was happening and put two things together that shouldn't have been put together, and then it made a leaping conclusion. And I would look at things that have happened to very large, well-respected organizations like the New York Times. I forget this private's name. I want to say it was like Private Lynch, Jessica Lynch, I want to say, right around the first Gulf War or second Gulf War. They put out a story and they stood behind their reporter. It turns out that reporter like had some sort of problems and put out something that was patently false. So it can happen, right? So I wouldn't be surprised if somebody, not to say they put something out false, but just some confluence of things happened and this story came out and we are going to see something big coming out of it, I think. Hmm. Like, I'd be surprised if either Amazon or Apple just let this sit still.
Right, right. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens, how it plays out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. All right. So this is a minor one. I'm sure it's been fixed by now, but I heard that some people, I believe Australia. I almost said Austria. If I'm not mistaken, Australia, let me just let's wait for this. Yeah, Australians are having some issues with the Apple Series Watch 4 and daylight savings time because I think they changed their clocks recently. I think we used to all change our clocks around this time of year, but I think we're a couple of weeks weeks away from daylight savings time switch, right? But yeah, they're having some trouble with the modular face that doesn't know how to handle a day that's an hour short, according to the, as long as this particular complication is active. So it's an interesting little story there. I haven't heard much more about it since it came out. Let's see, yeah, not much going on here, but...
Hopefully that gets patched, because I just looked it up, and for us in the United States and presumably Canada in the same way, ours will be Sunday, November 4th when we have the crossover again. So
after Halloween, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. In his date and calendar and components and all the other stuff, it's hard.
I know, we've always said that.
Kind of not surprised.
Themes of the daylight, show, right?
Daylight saving time bug, especially across different geographies, must be maddening and insane.
Sure, sure. All right. So, I mean, you got the one about the fix for 1201?
Yeah, some stuff in here I have not yet updated, so I have no opinion on it. Your mileage may vary. But mm-hmm. It says here that it fixes an issue where some iPhone XS devices did not immediately charge when connected to a lightning cable, which I don't have a XS, but my 10, I swear, I mean, maybe it's just a coincidence that maybe my lightning cable is old and busted and I should switch to a new one. But sometimes it feels like it doesn't want to charge either. Until I look at it, you know, pull it up, look at it, and it's like, oh, charging. All right, thanks. Nice, apparently, yeah. It also resolves an issue that could cause the iPhone XS to join a Wi-Fi network at 2.4 gigahertz instead of the desired 5 gigahertz. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'll have to update my iPad. It says it restores the original position of the period ?123 key on the iPad keyboard. I must not type that often on my iPad because I have no idea what they're talking about. I'll have to pull that out and take a look.
The position of the 123 key? Yeah, what the heck is that?
Yeah, is it in a weird spot? I feel like it was in the same spot, unless they adjusted it subtly, and people who are trying to almost like touch type based on the area where it should be were mistyping it.
I don't know. Let me have a look at my iPad right here. Just as a side note, Carol went to... Oh, yeah, it is a 123 key. Look at that.
Is it in a weird spot?
It's on either side of the... It's where the command key would be on your... Like into the space bar across the bottom, right? And then you've got... Then it's got the 123 key on either side of the space bar. So where mm-hmm. the command key would be is where it is, and where the option key on the right option key is where the dismiss keyboard button is, right?
Hmm.
So I didn't know that it was in a different place. So I don't know.
Yeah, maybe you should take a screenshot and then upgrade and then see if it's in a different spot.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do that. Let's do that right now.
And rounding out the issues here are fixing an issue where subtitles may not appear in some video apps, and addresses an issue where Bluetooth could become unavailable, which doesn't surprise me because I've had a little bit of an issue with connecting my Bluetooth headphones to my iPhone X on iOS 12, and I could not figure out what the pattern was. It seemed like maybe the phone had put itself to sleep or something. It never happened if I was actively engaged with the phone, like I had unlocked the phone and scrolling through a music app or listening to podcasts on Overcast or something. But I did notice that if my phone was just sort of sitting there and I turned on my headphones to connect, it wouldn't always connect, which is weird.
Yeah, I've had a few sound issues on my iPhone 10 with 12. I'm curious about that too. But it's funny, Carol had an interesting issue yesterday. Like her granddaughter always FaceTimes her mother in the morning on her way to school, and she uses Carol's phone to do that. And yesterday it got stuck in FaceTime. Like the call didn't connect, but Carol's phone, the FaceTime kept kicking in the front screen and trying to connect to answer this other call or something like that. And so we finally had to force the iPhone to shut down, you know, with the power button or the side button and the volume down button to get it to force it to, like, you know, reboot, right? Because it didn't matter what she did, she couldn't get hitting the home screen, home button. This is an iPhone 7, by the way. She couldn't get the home button to work or whatever. So interesting to see if that's another bug that hopefully these guys have fixed. Interesting. Who knows? Who knows? Only Apple knows. This is just literally just in. Carol just brought this story to me just before we started recording, and I forgot to put it in the notes, but I just have since done that. But apparently our own Canadian Broadcasting Network has sent in a bunch of investigative reporters to the Apple stores, I don't know which ones, around, I guess, in Canada here. And just a quick little brief story that they're claiming that the Apple geniuses are telling people to buy a new computer or a new piece of equipment rather than pay for the repairs to the equipment that they've got. So in some cases, it would be like $1,100 and even $100 in labor to repair these things. And yet, the reporter took the same computer to an independent repair person and they just found a bent pin inside the computer and fixed it. So we'll have to keep an eye on this one and see what happens with this story. There's a video here, which I'll have to watch afterward. I'll link in the show notes for people to watch it themselves. But yeah, just arrived. So I don't know. I mean, geniuses, I would think, are in the business of promoting Apple product. And a lot of times people may be bringing in really old hardware and it may behoove them to do it. But again, you know, once you get out of Apple care area, you know, like you're no longer under warranty, the repairs to like a logic board or something like that can be quite expensive, right? So you know, the justification, do you want to spend $800 on a logic board or, you know, $2,000 on a brand new computer and get more use out of it? So arguable, I suppose, right? What do you guys think?
Yeah, we'll have to hear more to see whether it's anyone is actually being malicious or deceitful, or is it that, you know, Apple just has expensive prices for repairs, which, would surprise no one if they did. And sometimes, you know, it does make more sense to just buy a new one instead of, you know, why would you pay $1,000 to repair a 5-year-old, 6-year-old computer if you can buy a new one for only a few $100 more?
Yeah, I generally haven't been taking stuff in. The only things I've taken into the Apple store lately and I've seen repaired are the things like phone screens, like cracked phone screens getting replaced, or like I had I think they called it the lightsaber effect on my iPhone 10 with the green line down the side. And I've seen what Apple does is they'll take the phone in and actually when they bring your phone back out to you, they bring it with, if there's another underneath it, is it like a white box with a replacement in it? And because if the repair doesn't work, then they'll sell you that repair or brand new version of the phone, or like a I don't know if it's refurbed or whatever, but they'll sell you a replacement for less than you know you would pay for it as if it was new, right? But again I'm a proponent of Apple Care and Apple, you know, on my devices if I can afford it. But yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say. I've been in the Apple game for a long time, and I know that, you know, replacing logic boards is probably one of the most expensive things. And now with the MacBook Pros, you know, the hard drive is part of the logic board. So you can't change the RAM out anymore. So it's kind of, if you spill water on your computer, you're going to replace the whole logic board, and that's going to cost you some bucks, right? Or beaucoup d'argent, I heard. Beaucoup is something I think I heard Harmy say a couple of weeks ago. Do you know what that means, Harmy?
Beaucoup.
Beaucoup means very much.
Like merci beaucoup? Like that? Merci beaucoup in French?
Was it reflection to, you were talking about having to pay a lot of money or have a lot of things, and you said beaucoup in an episode a couple of weeks ago.
Like beaucoup bucks? I'm not even sure that's spelled. I hope it's not an offensive word, but my understanding is it's just like a whole bunch of dollars.
It is. Beaucoup means a lot. Yeah. Thank you very much is beaucoup, what you just said. Merci beaucoup.
I didn't realize. I've literally never seen somebody write down beaucoup bucks, so I didn't realize that it was an anglicized pronunciation of the French word.
Uh-huh. Well, I thought you were being bilingual. What do I
know? No. If I end up going to NS North, I'm going to be woefully out of place in Montreal.
Well, I was actually going to do the intro in French. I'm still working on it, but because when NS North comes to Montreal, you guys are going to have to brush up on your Francais. All right. So we're at the Pickorama time, and we've got quite a few picks here. So let's dig in. Jaime, what do you got for picks?
This one is a blast from the past. So the folks at Adafruit are writing about the fact that the Logo, if you remember the Turtle Graphics programming language from MIT, has been open source. So apparently this was on the Apple II computers. That's probably where I ended up using it. But you can see on the PDP-10 GitHub repo for Logo, you can see, I'm not even sure, GitHub's acting kind of finicky. It is a ton of lines of what looks to be assembler, 13,450 lines here that you can go, and people have actually done pull requests, because one of the bits on here on like Space War apparently was part of this whole setup. So people have added the Star Trek, the original series Enterprise, and like a D7 Klingon cruiser to the pull request. So hopefully that gets merged in, but it's kind of fun to see the way this was written. I don't really know PDP-10 assembler, so I can't really read a lot of it. There are things that make sort of sense as wordy, as like, you know, check buffers, you know, run flag, but some of these other ones like WND left, I'm window left, maybe a couple other things, more of a curiosity than anything else. I do remember the pen up, pen down, you know, left, right sort of commands you could put in and try to, like, as a wee baby programmer, learn how to try to draw something, even like a circle or a square would be sort of complicated as a little kid, but fun fun to really like see that with the little turtle logo doing that.
Interesting. Well, lots of fun. And I noticed that too, that in the graphic that they have printed there on the image, the original Apple font too, with their Apple logo font. But that's cool. So what's the next pick you got there, Jaime?
Yeah, this is a second pick because I just recorded an episode with Steve Westgarth, the conference organizer for Code Mobile UK, which is a conference that I'm going to speak at. So episode two here is linked in the show notes for your listening pleasure. The conference website will probably say have that linked in the show notes, as well as I'll go ahead and say that tickets are on sale. The conference is taking place in April in Chester, UK, the University of Chester. So if people want to come hang out, say hello, or at the very least just listen to the podcast, got your links there.
Get some MCJC t-shirts. How much is the conference?
Let me see what the tickets are. I think it's still on early bird.
I've seen some UK conferences where the prices are really low.
Let's see here.
Compared to US.
So super early bird, which is conference plus 3 nights accommodation is £285 plus £57 VAT, which I think is their tax.
Mm-hmm.
Super early bird conference only is £180 plus $36 VAT, and then so on and so forth. So if you're in the UK, I'm assuming it's a sort of a no-brainer in terms of the amount of money. If you are having to go international, you might have to consider that given the you know, prices of airlines and everything. But I'd definitely say it's the sort of thing you could have your employer. So start thinking about getting that lined up, right? Start thinking about 2019's conference schedule that you'd like to attend and
deal with. Add it to the list of conferences for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
It looks like, I zoomed out on the map, it looks like Chester is just south of Liverpool and, you know, near Manchester. Sort of in the area that Mick Pringle lives, you know?
I didn't know. I know very, very little about that geography. And I also did look it up and realize like, oh, I think Manchester City is in town, so maybe I'll be able to check out a soccer or football game, as I should call it over there. I was chatting with Steve, and apparently, depending on when we arrive, if things go as scheduled, the UK might have just Brexited the day before, like March 31st, I think, is the deadline. Don't quote me. I know very little at all about what's going on with Brexit.
Nice.
But that might impact your plans if you're trying to come from the European Union, because they will figure out those rules. But for those of us coming from outside the European Union, presumably it continues as usual. For example, United States and Canada are probably still the same since, I wouldn't see why it would necessarily change. So we're not really involved in that.
True. Cool. All right. I have a couple of picks here. One is a quick one. I think and this might actually be follow-up because I vaguely remember talking about iPhone X and layout and things like that. But this is from the webkit.org people, a article, blog post from last year, actually, on designing websites for iPhone X. Again, because of the whole sensor area, also known as the notch, you need to utilize safe area as well. And so this talks about how to create your viewport settings and apply them in such a way that that you respect the safe areas. And there's a couple of environment variables you can set for the bottom and left and right. So when you're in landscape mode, to avoid the padding. And also how to adjust your style sheets to avoid the those areas as well. So interesting article here. And that's a link in the show notes for peoples.
Yeah, that can be a little challenging. I was working with a web developer on a WebView integration, and it was something that they definitely had to be made aware of. It's like, hey, this is shoved all the way to the wrong spot on the iPhone X. Let's fire up the simulator to get you set up with that so you can figure some of these things out. And I don't know if this link came across my list when I was searching for, you know, I'm not a web developer. I did that a long time ago. I was like looking for stuff to have and hand over, but like, look, here, do this. This definitely would have been helpful for that situation. So plus one to your link.
Cool. Right. Yep. My next pick and my final pick of the day. This is, I got this from a friend on the Ray Winterlick team, Darren Ferguson, posted today on our Cool Links page that there is now a REPL for supporting Swift packages. REPL is obviously, as we've talked about in the past, is part of the Swift language. But this is so you can actually have a dash dash REPL, REPL WPL hook on your commands on Swift when you're running it. So if you're dealing with some examples here, they're showing how to use YAML examples here and it will let you import frameworks and other things into your and use a REPL instead of having to create a throwaway Swift project or a macOS project for iOS to, or actually also works on Linux, to support your ventures in the land of development and testing. So also lets you use things like frameworks. So if you're using like Viper or HTTP requests, if you want to serialize some JSON, you can do that. And if you want to use Apple's framework or JSON serialization to deal with the actual input and convert it into something usable for you in Swift, you can do that as well. So this is the new REPL switch in Swift language itself running on the command line.
That's pretty cool, because I haven't done a ton with the REPL, if I'm being quite honest. I tend to use Playgrounds, but so funny enough, I looked on Wikipedia to see what exactly does REPL stand for, because I completely forgot since we last talked about it, probably in like early days of Swift. It's Read Eval Print Loop, REPL, also known as an interactive top level or language shell, which lets you interactively line by line write code. So I can see now why they had to add specific support for Swift packages to let the REPL be more powerful than it already is. So that's really cool.
Cool. So that's it. That's my pick. Alrighty. Okay. Well, I guess that's it for the week again. So hopefully we'll have something exciting to talk about in the future. But yeah. So Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you on the interwebs, where will they look?
I'm on Twitter as @devwithahair.
Alrighty. And Mark, if people want to get in touch with you,
markr@smepsoft.com.
All right. And as I say every week, my name is Tim Mitra, TimMitra on the Twitter machine, and that's the best way to get a hold of me. Okay. So until next week, we'll say bye bye.
Bye. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fm. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at mtjc_podcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskMTJC. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/mtjc. You can find details on how to help us out on our website at mtjc.fm/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah, what else is going on besides Apple overcharging for stuff?
Let's see. Yeah. What's happened this week?
We're having a company retreat next 2 days. I'm headed up to Napa, which will be kind of fun. So the whole company is going up there. They got a big house. We're all just kind of hanging out for a couple of days. Kind of fun.
Cool.
And the Red Sox have advanced to the ALCS. They beat the Yankees. Right. I know you were on the edge of your seat during the game last night.
I probably was. I didn't realize it at the time.
Yep.
Actually, I was enjoying my Pat Metheny concert yesterday.
Oh, that's so true. Yeah. And for all you know, some of the members of the Blue Jays might have been in the crowd too, because
that's true.
They weren't playing.
That's true. Yeah. Maybe they were, they're golf clubs or something.
Yeah.
So it looks like it's the Houston Astros versus the Boston Red Sox.
It is.
Saturday, the 13th of October. Okay.
It is. Should be a good series. Hmm. The Red Sox they have home field advantage because they won more games this season. They won 108 games and Astros won 103, which is very unusual for two teams who both won 100 games in the to play each other in the playoffs. And it's happened twice now because this series that the Red Sox just beat the Yankees in was another one where the Yankees had won 100 games. So it's an interesting season in baseball.
Again, so I see
you guys are falling asleep when I talk about that.
But. No, I'm not. I just admit I didn't watch the wild card or the
division series.
The divisional series either. Yeah. But I'm looking here at the NLCS, the National League has the Dodgers and the Brewers.
Right.
So putting on my If I was the league, I would absolutely want Boston and LA, the two large markets, East and West Coast, to make it. I'd be terrified that the Milwaukee Brewers and the Houston Astros would be there just for TV ratings purposes.
Yeah. Well, the Astros are kind of a popular team now since they won the World Series last year. But
yeah, I guess they get some love.
Yeah, the Brewers for sure are a small market team. Hmm. Yeah, if it had been, say, the Brewers against Cleveland or something, that would have been not a ratings bonanza.
Yeah.
On Spotcast, Tim was talking about hockey, and the only thing I know about hockey is that we might get it in Seattle in 2020.
Yeah.
We're just hoping. Apparently stuff has happened with the NHL and Seattle. We've got things lined up, but it really just depends on other things. So I'm not getting my hope up yet.
That is really a long time follow-up there, Jaime.
We'll talk about it. We've officially talked about it. So if it ends up on the show
months ago
in 2020, we'll talk about it.
Nice. Yeah.
Because I'm sitting there and utterly baffled and confused and asking you stuff.
Mm-hmm. Just flipping through some images here on the Comic-Con costumes for the New York Comic-Con we were talking about.
Mm-hmm. People do some wild stuff. Like, you know, cosplay type stuff used to be, somebody was sort of good at sewing their own costume together. And now people are 3D printing stuff and using latex professionally and manufacturing pieces that they have to like engineer together with moving parts. It's amazing.
Yeah, for sure. Did you see last week's logo on the show?
Yeah, was that a 3D printed logo?
Yeah, I'm trying to prototype a button design or like a enamel pin design. So I was playing around with my 3D software and my printer.
Oh, that would be kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course I was prototyping it bigger than it will be produced, but someday. There's some nice looking pins out there. I'm just going to find out where they're getting made. Like the ones that Randy Ritchie just did for the Viper show or Vector show. They look like the ones that they were giving away at WWDC, but, because they have the card, right?
Oh, yeah. I bet you he was able to ask Apple where they get theirs manufactured.
Yeah, no, I think it was done through, that's what I was asking you about Dave Wilkes, because that was done through his community, I forget what they call themselves. But
so I just did a Google search on make pins.
Yeah.
First thing that came up is the studio. .com custom enamel pins. They look pretty good.
Yeah. I got a bunch of names from different people. Just trying to find somebody who'll give me a price on them. Mm-hmm. Around $235 or something like that for like $100.
Mm, that seems not bad.
Yeah. That's for like a die struck one, right? But I don't know how they make them. So.
Yeah, they're probably not hand painted.
No. No, I did copper enamel stuff like that in high school. So I'm not planning on making 100 pins. I probably could actually now that I think about it.
Pinmart has them for $1 a piece.
Like 3/4 inch ones, or printed, or die struck.
Don't know. Die struck.
Was it Pinmart?
Die struck. Yeah. Well, okay. It's not clear that those are 99 cents each.
Right. It depends on the quantity you buy, right? Mm-hmm. That's what I'm finding. Like it'll take us a long time to get rid of 100 pins. That's how many stickers I bought last time, right? So, yeah, John Milko gave me the name of the company that he had his done at. I think it was something like that, Pinmart, or I forget what he said. But yeah, and there are some Canadian manufacturers who do it as well. So I thought I'd ask them, especially if Jaime's going over to the UK, right?
I was thinking, let's see how many questionable things we can shove into my bag.
Yeah.
And see what the British think when I show up at their door.
The gendarmes, yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I've been podcasting for the last 4 hours, it seems, or three hours, I guess, right?
Let's see, since six my time, with a little break in between.
Yeah. I needed that break too. Anyway, I'll talk to you guys. Here's John Walker. I'll just talk to you guys later.
Okay.
All right. Talk to you later.
Bye.
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 Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.